The Cleaner, a John Milton novel by Mark Dawson. Read by David Thorpe. We deal in lead, friend. Vin, The Magnificent Seven. Prologue. The road through the forest was tranquil, the gentle quiet embroidered by the gurgling of a mountain rill and the chirruping of the birds in the canopy of trees overhead. The Route Forestière de la Condire was potholed and narrow, often passable by just one car at a time. Evergreen pine forests clustered tightly on either side, pressing a damp gloom onto the road that was dispelled by warm sunlight wherever the trees had been chopped back. The misty slopes of the massif of the Montagne de Charbon stretched above the tree line, ribs of rock and stone running down through the vegetation. The road followed a careful route up the flank of the mountain, turning sharply to the left and right, and sometimes switching back on itself as it traced the safest path upwards. The road crossed and recrossed the stream, and the humpback bridge here was constructed from ancient red bricks, held together as much by the damp lichen that clung to it as by its disintegrating putty. The bridge was next to a small enclosure signed as a car park, although that was putting it at its highest. It was little more than a lay-by, hewn from the hillside, a clearing barely large enough to fit four cars side by side. Forestry reserve notices warned of wild animals and hunters. It was a quiet and isolated spot, the outside world excluded almost as if by the closing of a door. Milton had parked his Renault there, nudged against the shoulder of the mountain. It was a nondescript hire car. He had chosen it because it was unremarkable. He had reversed into the space, leaving the engine running as he stepped out and made his way around to the boot. He unlocked and opened it and looked down at the bundle nestled in the car's small storage space. He unfolded the edges of the blanket to uncover the assault rifle that had been left at the dead drop the previous night. It was an HK-53 carbine with integrated suppressor, the rifle that the SAS often used when stealth was as important as stopping power. Milton lifted the rifle from the boot and pressed a fresh 25-round magazine into the breech. He opened the collapsible stock and took aim, pointing down the middle of the road. Satisfied that the weapon was functioning correctly, he made his way towards the bridge and rested it in the undergrowth out of sight. Milton had scouted the area and knew it well. To the north, the road eventually led to Saint-Joriot, a medium-sized tourist resort that gathered along the shore of Lake Annecy. The descent to the south led to the small village of Chevaline. The village made its living from farming, but that was supplemented by renting the picturesque chalet farmhouses to the tourists who came for cycling and hiking. Milton had stayed in just such a chalet for the past 3 days. He had spent his time scouting the area, departing on his bike early in the morning and returning late at night. He had kept a low profile, staying in the chalet apart from those trips out. Milton heard the engine of the BMW long before he saw it. He collected the rifle and slipped behind the trunk of an oak, hiding himself from the road, but still able to observe it. The wine-coloured estate car was in second gear, struggling a little with the steep camber of the road. It emerged from the sharp right-hand turn, its lights illuminating a path through the gloom. The car slowed and turned in towards the Renault. Milton held his breath, his pulse ticking up, and slipped his index finger through the trigger guard of the rifle. The driver parked alongside and switched off the engine. Milton could hear music from the interior of the car. The passenger side door opened and the muffled music became clearer. French pop, disposable and inoffensive. The passenger bent down and spoke sharply into the car and the music was silenced. For a moment, all Milton could hear was the crunch of the man's shoes on the gravel, the rushing of the water and the wind in the leaves. He tightened his grip on the rifle and concentrated on keeping his breathing even and regular. The driver's side door opened, and a tall, dark-skinned woman stepped outside. Milton recognized both of them. The passenger was Yahya al-Musa. The driver was Samira Najib. He stepped out from behind the trunk and brought the HK-53 to bear. He flicked the selector to automatic and fired off a volley of shots. The bullets struck Najib in the gut, perforating her liver and lungs. She put a hand to her breast, confusion spreading across her face, and then pivoted and fell back against the side of the car. Najib shrieked, moving quickly, ducking down beneath the line contour of the car. Milton took two smooth sidesteps to his right to open up the angle again and squeezed off another burst. The scientist was trying to get back into the car. The bullets tattooed his body in a line from throat to crotch. The fusillade sounded around the trees for a moment. Frightened birds exploded into the air on wingbeats that sounded like claps. The echo of the reports died and faded away, and then, short moments after the brutal outburst of violence, all was quiet again. The wind rustled through the trees, the water chimed beneath the bridge, a nightingale called from high above. Milton paused. There was another sound, a second car approaching. Hiding would have been pointless. The bloody tableau would give him away. The car emerged from the mouth of the forest. It was a Renault Megane, painted blue with white and red chevrons screen printed across the bonnet. The policeman in the front of the car must have seen him immediately. The Megane came to a sudden stop 50 feet away. Milton ejected the magazine and slapped in a replacement. The officer opened the door and stepped out of the car, his hand on the butt of his holstered pistol.
"Arrête!"
he called out. Milton did not pause to think. His reaction was hardwired, a response that had been drilled into him across 10 years, so that now it was automatic, an expression of muscle memory without conscience, sudden and terribly deadly. He swung the rifle around and squeezed the trigger for a longer burst. The car was peppered with bullets, half a dozen slamming into the radiator and bonnet, another handful into the windscreen. The officer was struck in the face and chest, stumbling backwards and then dropping onto his back, where he lay for a moment, twitching horribly. Milton walked towards him, the gun cradled low, and put a final bullet into his head. Finally, the man lay still. Peacefulness returned, ornamented now by the sound of the shards of glass that fell to shatter on the road from the breached windscreen. Milton crossed the road to the Renault. He opened the boot and wrapped the rifle in its blanket, then stowed it away carefully beneath the spare wheel in the false floor. He pulled on a pair of latex gloves and collected the ejected shell casings from the rifle. There were 40 of them, and they were still hot to the touch. He dropped them into a small evidence bag. He crouched by Najib's body and frisked her quickly and efficiently. He found her smartphone and a USB stick and bagged them both. He went around to the other side of the car and lowered himself to examine al-Musa. The door was open, and as he raised his gaze from the body to peer inside, he saw a small, pale face staring back out at him. Milton did not rush. There was no need. The face belonged to a young boy, perhaps 5 or 6 years old. His skin and his hair were dark, and his features recalled those of his parents. He was cowering in the footspace, a streak of blood across his forehead, as if it was paint that had been thrown over him. It was not his blood. It was blowback from his father. Milton reached for the Sig Sauer he carried in his shoulder holster, his fingers brushing against the butt. The boy held his eyes. His face was white and quivering with fright, but he did not look away. He was brave. Milton felt a swell of vomit in his throat as his memory cast him back 20 years and 1,000 miles away. He remembered another young boy, a similar age, the face peaceful despite the obscenity of his death. He lowered his hand from the Sig and stepped back. He gently pulled the man's body onto the muddy surface of the lay-by and went back to the car.
"Stay there," he told the boy. "Help is coming."
He closed the door, he checked that he had removed the evidence of his presence, and, satisfied, got into the Renault, put it into gear, and drove away. He turned to the north, upwards, and drove towards the lake. Part 1. The Cleaner. The man was on the bed, his hands clenched into claws over his heart and his teeth grinding over and over again. His eyelids flickered and sometimes he moaned, strangled words that would have made no sense if anyone had been there to hear them. His body was rigid with tension, sweat drenching his body in the sheets. The dream came more often now, sometimes every night, always the same. He was lying prone, flat in the cushioned warmth of sand dunes. The sun was directly above him, a midday sun that pounded the desert with a brutal heat that made the air shimmer, the mountains in the distance swaying as if viewed through the water of a fish tank. The landscape was arid, long swathes of dead sand that stretched for as far as the eye could see. The only vegetation was close to the banks of the slow-moving river that eventually found its way into the Tigris. A single ribbon of asphalt was the only road for miles around, deep drifts of sand blown across it. Chapter 1. Control squinted through the windscreen of the XJS as he pulled into the empty fast lane and accelerated past a lumbering articulated lorry. The sky had been a bloody crimson last night, and when the sun returned in the morning it had risen into a clear, untrammelled blue sky. There was heat and light in those early rays, and he angled the blind to shade his eyes. The radio was tuned to the Today programme, and the forecaster predicted a week of searing heat. The 7 o'clock news followed the weather. The lead item was the shooting of two tourists and a policeman in the French Alps. The victims had been identified, but, as yet, a motive for the killing had not been found. It was senseless, a French policeman concluded. That, Control thought, was not true. It was far from senseless. The operation had been the result of long and meticulous planning, 6 months spent cultivating the targets and gaining their trust, and then weeks setting up the meeting. The objective had been successfully achieved, but it had not been clean. There were two errors that would need careful handling, errors that raised doubts over the performance of the man who had carried out the operation. The fact that it was number one was troubling. It had been Control's operation. He knew the targets intimately. Yahya Al-Moussa had been an atomic research scientist. Samira Najib was an expert in microwave technology. They were married, and until recently, both had been in the employ of the Iraq Atomic Energy Agency. Following the fall of Saddam, they had been recruited by the Iranians, and with their help, the Ahmadinejad regime had made progress towards its goal of becoming a nuclear power. A decision had been made somewhere in MI5 that the couple was too dangerous to live. That decision had been rubber-stamped in another anonymous grey office in Whitehall, and their files had been marked with red and passed to Group 15 to be actioned. It was important, and because of that, Control had selected number one for the assignment. As he turned the Jaguar off the motorway at the exit for central London, Control reviewed his preparation. The two had come to France under the pretext of a long-deserved holiday. The real reason, however, and the reason for their diversion into the Alpine countryside, was to meet an employee of Cesus, a subsidiary of Areva, the global leader in the market for zirconium. That metal was used, among other things, for nuclear fuel cladding. Iran needed zirconium for its reactors, and Al-Moussa and Najib had been led to believe that their contact could supply as much as they needed. But there had been no employee. There was no zirconium. There was to be no meeting, at least not the rendezvous that they had been expecting. Control tapped out a rhythm on the steering wheel as he passed into London. No, he thought. The preparation had been faultless. The problems were all of Milton's making. The dead gendarme would give the French police a strong personal motive to locate the killer. One of their own had been murdered. It would make them more tenacious and less likely to shelve the investigation when the trail went cold, as Control knew that it would. That was bad, but even worse was the boy. A child, orphaned by the killer, cowering in the car as he watched his parents' murders. That was dynamite, the hook upon which the press would be able to hang all of their reporting. It ensured the story would run and run. Control slowed and turned the Jaguar into the underground car park beneath a small building huddled on the north bank of the Thames. It was a 60s build, constructed from brick and concrete without style or grace. 5 floors, anonymous. The car idled as the garage door rolled up with a tired metallic creak. The sign painted onto the door read Global Logistics. He drove inside, pulled up next to the secure elevator, and got out of the car. The lift arrived, and he embarked, pressing the button for the 3rd floor. The lift eased to a halt, the doors sighed open, and he stepped out into the bustling open-plan space beyond. Analysts stared at monitors and tapped at keyboards, printers chattered, and telephones chimed incessantly. Control passed through the chaotic space to a corridor lined with thick carpet, following it around to the right so that the clamour behind him faded to a gentle hum of activity. A number of green baize doors faced the corridor, and he picked the one at the end, pushing it open and walking through. David Tanner, his private secretary, looked up from his computer.
"Monitor,"
he said. Tanner was ex-army, infantry, like Control, and all of the other operatives who worked for him. Tanner's career had been forestalled by an IED on the road outside Kabul. It had cost him his right leg below the knee and the posting to the SAS that he had craved. He was a good man, easygoing and pleasant to share a drink with, and he guarded access to his commanding officer with fierce dedication.
"Morning, Captain," he said. "What does the morning look like?"
"You're speaking to the director at midday. Wants an update on the French situation."
"I'm sure she does. And number one?"
"Waiting for you inside, sir."
"Very good."
He went through into the office. It was a large room that offered an expansive view of the river. It was pleasant and light, close carpeted in dove grey Wilton. The military prints on the walls were expensively framed. A mantelpiece bore a number of silver trophies and 2 photographs in luxurious leather frames. One was of Control as a younger man in full battle dress, and the other was of his wife and 3 children. There was a central table with a bowl of flowers and 2 comfortable club chairs on either side of the fire. There were no filing cabinets and nothing that looked official. Milton was standing at the wide window at the other end of the room, smoking a cigarette and looking down on the broad sweep of the Thames. Control paused by the door and regarded him. He was dressed in a plain dark suit that looked rather cheap, a white shirt and a black tie.
"Good morning, number one," he said.
"Morning, sir."
"Take a seat."
He watched as Milton sat down. His eyes were implacable. He looked a little shabby, a little worn around the edges. Control recalled him when he joined the service. He had sported Savile Row suits, shirts from Turnbull and Asser, and was perfectly groomed at all times. He did not seem to care for any of that any longer. Control didn't care what his agents looked like, so long as they were good at their job, and Milton was his best. That was why this latest misadventure was so troubling. There came a knock at the door. Tanner entered, bearing a tray with a pot of tea and 2 bone china cups. He set the tray down on the sideboard and, after confirming that there was nothing else that Control needed, he left them alone. Control got up and poured the tea, watching Milton as he did so. One did not apply for a job like his. One was chosen. And as was his habit with all the operatives who worked for him, Control had selected him himself and then supervised the year of rigorous training that smoothed away his rough edges and prepared him for his new role. There had been moments when Milton had doubted his own suitability for the position, and Control had not so much as assuaged the doubts as chided him for even entertaining the possibility that his judgment might have been awry. He prided himself on being an excellent judge of character, and he had known that Milton would be the perfect field agent. He had been proved right. Milton had started his career as number 12, as was customary, and now, 10 years later, all his predecessors were gone, and he was number one. Milton was tense. He gripped the armrest of the chair so tightly that his knuckles whitened. He had not shaved that morning, the strong line of his jaw darkly stubbled. "The boy?" he said.
"Traumatized, but otherwise fine, from what we can gather. As you would expect, the French have him in care. We don't think they've spoken to him yet."
"Did he see you?"
"Yes."
"That could be awkward."
Milton ignored him. "Did you know?"
"Know what?"
"That he'd be there."
"We knew he was in France. We didn't think they would bring him to the meeting."
"And you didn't think to tell me that they might?"
"Remember who you're talking to," Control said angrily. "Would it have made a difference?"
Milton's cold stare burned into him. "There's no point in pretending otherwise. The boy is a problem, the damned policeman too. It would have been tidy without them, but now, well, they're both loose ends. They make things more complicated."
"You'd better tell me what happened."
"There's not much to say. I followed the plan to the letter. The weapon was where it was supposed to be. I arrived before the targets. They were there on time. I eliminated both. As I was tidying up, the gendarme arrived. So I shot him."
"The rules of engagement were clear."
"Indeed, sir. No witnesses. I don't believe I had a choice."
"You didn't. I'm not questioning that."
"But you're questioning something," Milton said. Again, his tone was harsh. Control ignored it.
"You said it yourself.
No witnesses."
"The boy.
Why I didn't shoot him?"
"It might be distasteful, but you know how clear we are about how we conduct ourselves on operations."
Control was tense. The conversation was not developing as he had anticipated, and he was not in the business of being surprised. There was a whiteness around the edges of Milton's lips. The blue eyes still stared blankly, almost unseeingly.
"I've seen a lot of dead bodies since I've been working for you, sir."
Control replied with as much patience as he could manage.
"Of course you have, Milton. You're an assassin.
Dead bodies are your stock in trade."
He might not even have heard him.
"I can't keep pretending to myself anymore. We make decisions about who lives and who dies, but it's not always black and white when you're in the middle of it. As you say, the rules of engagement were clear. I should have shot him. 10 years ago, when I signed up for this..."
The word carried a light dusting of contempt.
"I probably would have shot him, like a good soldier."
"But you didn't."
"I couldn't."
"Why are you telling me this?"
10 years is a long time for this kind of work, sir. Longer than anyone else. And I haven't been happy lately. I don't think I've ever really been happy."
"I don't expect you to be happy."
Milton had become agitated and pressed on.
I've got blood on my hands. I used to tell myself the same things to justify it, but they don't work anymore. That policeman didn't deserve to die. The boy didn't deserve to lose his parents. We made a widow and an orphan because of a lie. And I'm not doing it any longer, sir. I'm finished.
Control spoke carefully. Are you trying to resign?
You can call it whatever you like. My mind is made up.
Control rose. He needed a moment to tamp down his temper. This was perilously close to insubordination, and rather than lash out, he went across to the mantelpiece and adjusted the photograph of his family. He spoke carefully.
What's the group for, Milton?
Framing, extortion, elimination.
Jobs that are too dirty for Her Majesty's security services to touch.
Quite so, sir.
And your job?
Cleaner.
Which means?
From time to time, Her Majesty's government needs to remove people whose continued existence poses a risk to the effective conduct of public order. The government requires particularly skilled professionals who are prepared to work on a non-attributable basis to deal with these problems. Cleaners.
He smiled without humour. That was the job description he had used when he recruited him all those years ago. All those neutral euphemisms, all designed to make the job easier to palate.
It takes a special kind of man to do that kind of work.
There are so few of you, and, unfortunately, that makes you rather difficult to replace. He paused.
Do you know how many people you've eliminated for me?
Milton replied without even thinking. 136. You're my best cleaner.
Once, perhaps. Not anymore.
I can't ignore it any longer. I can't keep my mouth shut just to avoid being unprofessional. I'm lying to myself.
We have to face facts, sir.
Dress it up however you like. Neutralization, elimination. But those are just euphemisms for what it is I really do. I am paid to murder people.
Control was not getting through to him.
Murder? He exclaimed. What are you talking about, man? Don't be so soft. You want to moralize?
You know what would happen if the Iranians get the bomb? There'll be a war. A proper war that will make Iraq look like a walk in the bloody park. Thousands of people will die. Hundreds of thousands. Removing those two made that prospect a little less likely. And they knew the risk they were taking. You can call it murder if you like, but they were not innocents. They were combatants.
And the policeman? The boy?
Unfortunate but necessary.
Collateral damage?
Control felt he was being goaded. He took a breath and replied with a taut, "Indeed." Milton folded his arms.
"I'm sorry, sir. I'm done with you. I'm finished."
Control walked up to Milton, circled him close, noticed the tension in the shoulders and the clenched fists.
No one is ever really finished with me.
You can't resign. You can't retire. You're a murderer, as you say. It's all you know. After all, what can you chaps do after you leave me? Your talents are so specialised. You use a gun. You use your fists. You use a knife. What else could you do? Work with children? In an office? No. You're unskilled labour man. This is what you are.
Then find yourself another labourer.
He banged a fist on the mantelpiece in frustration.
You work for me as long as I bloody well want you to, or I'll have you destroyed.
Milton rose to face him. His stature was imposing, and his eyes were chilling. They had regained their clarity and icy focus. They were the eyes of a killer. And he fixed him in a pitiless gaze.
I think we're finished, sir, aren't we? We're not going to agree with each other.
Is that your final word?
It is.
Control put his desk between them and sat down.
You're making a terrible mistake. You're on suspension, unpaid.
I'll review your file, but there will be discipline.
Take the time to consider your position.
It isn't too late to repair the damage this foolish stand has caused you.
Very good, sir.
Milton straightened his tie.
You're dismissed.
Good day, sir.
Chapter 2. Milton found a bar. His anonymous, empty hotel room did not appeal to him. The confrontation with Control had unsettled him. His hands were shaking from anger and fear. There was a place with a wide picture window that faced the river. He found a table that looked out onto the open water, the buildings on the opposite bank, the pleasure craft and barges churning through the surf, and above, the blazing sun in a perfectly clear sky. He wanted a large whiskey, to feel the alcohol, his head beginning to spin just a little. He knew one way to stop thinking about everything could be found in the bottom of his glass, but he managed to resist the urge. It was short-term relief with long-term consequences. He focused on the number that he kept in his head, 691, and ordered an orange juice instead. He sat, brooding, turning the glass between his fingers, watching the boats. There was a television above the bar. The volume was turned down, with subtitles running along the bottom of the screen. The channel had been set to one of the 24-hour news programmes, and an interview with a minister on Parliament Green was abruptly replaced by an overhead helicopter shot of a wooded mountain landscape. A caption flashed that it was near Lake Annecy, France. The camera jerked and zoomed until the screen was filled with a shot of a wine-coloured BMW. It was parked in a small clearing. The camera zoomed out, and a second car, blue with white and red chevrons, could be seen. Bloodstains were visible on the muddy ground around the cars. The captions along the bottom of the screen said "massacre" and "outrage". The bartender shook his head.
"Did you see that?" Milton grunted. "You know, they found a boy in the car."
Milton said nothing.
"I don't know how someone could do that. Murder a family on holiday. How cold-blooded is that? You ask me, that little boy was lucky. If whoever it was had found him, I reckon he would have been shot too."
The news report switched to another story, but it was no good. Milton finished the juice and stood. He needed to leave.
Chapter 3. The platform for the underground was busy. A group of young foreign travellers who didn't know any better had congregated near the slope that led up to the surface, blocking the way with their suitcases and chattering excitedly in Portuguese. Their luggage was plastered with stickers that proclaimed their previous destinations. Brazilians, he guessed. Students. Milton picked his way through them so he could wait at the quieter, less populated end of the platform. There was a lone traveller there, standing right up at the edge. She was black, in her early 30s, and wearing the uniform of one of the fast food chains that served the area around the station. She looked tired, and Milton saw that she was crying, her bottom lip quivering and tears rolling down her cheeks. Milton was not good with empathy, and he would not have known where to start were he to try to comfort her, but he had no interest in that. Not today. He had too much on his mind. He moved along. He felt awful again. His mood had worsened. He felt lightheaded and slumped down onto an empty bench. He started to sweat, his hands first, then his back, salty beads rolling down from his scalp into his eyes and mouth. He recalled the overhead shot of the forest from the television helicopter. There had been three pegs on the ground, marking the spots where the bodies had been found. He knew he should stop, think of something else, but
but he couldn't. And soon he recalled the nightmare again, the flashes from years before, the flattened village. The blood splashed over the arid ground, the body of the boy, the peppery smell of high explosives and cloying death. He floated away from that, running onto all the other things he had done and seen in the service of queen and country. Dingy rooms and darkened streets, 136 victims laid out in evidence of the terrible things he had done. A shot to the head from a sniper rifle, a knife to the heart, a garrote around the throat pulled tight until the hacking breaths became wheezes that became silent, a body desperately jerking, then falling still. 136 men and women faced him, accused him, their blood on his hands. A loud scream yanked him around. The students were staring down the platform at him. He took it all in, the details. Was it him they were pointing at? No. They were pointing away from him. The woman wasn't there. Another scream, and one of the students pointed down onto the track. Milton stumbled to his feet and saw her deliberately laid across the rails. It was an incongruous sight. At first he thought she must have been trying to collect something that she had dropped, but then he realised that she had laid herself out in that fashion for a purpose. He spun around. The glowing digital sign said the next train was approaching, and then Milton heard it, the low rumble as the carriages rolled around the final bend in the tunnel. There wasn't any time to consider what to do. There was an emergency button on the wall 50 feet away, but he knew he wouldn't be able to reach it in time, and even if he did, he doubted the train would be able to stop. He jumped down from the platform onto the sleepers. He stepped over the live rail. The train drew nearer, a blast of warm air pouring out of the mouth of the tunnel. Milton knelt down by the woman. "No," she said, "leave me alone." He slipped one hand beneath her back and the other beneath her knees. She was slight and he lifted her easily. The train turned the final bend, its headlights shining brightly. Its horn sounded shrill and sudden, and Milton knew it was going to be touch and go. He stepped over the live rail again and threw the woman up onto the platform. The train's brakes bit, the locked wheels sliding across the metal with a hideous shriek as Milton planted his hands on the lip of the platform and vaulted up, rolling away just as the engine groaned by, missing him by fractions. He rolled over onto his back and stared up at the curved ceiling. His breath rushed in and out. The train had stopped halfway into the station. The driver opened the door and sprinted down the platform towards him.
"Are you all right, mate?"
"Fine. Check her." He closed his eyes and forced his breathing to return to a regular pattern. In and out. In and out.
"I thought you was a goner," the driver said. "I thought I was going to hit you both. What happened?"
Milton didn't answer. The students had made their way down the platform, and the driver turned his attention to them. They reported what they had seen in sing-song broken English, how the woman had lowered herself from the platform and laid herself out across the rails, how Milton had gone down after her and pulled her away from danger.
"You're a bloody hero, mate,"
the driver said. Milton closed his eyes again. A hero. He would have laughed if that wasn't so ridiculous. It was a bad joke. Chapter 4. An ambulance arrived soon afterwards. Milton sat next to the woman on the bench as she was attended to by the paramedics. She had cried hysterically for 5 minutes, but she quickly stopped, and by the time the paramedics had arrived, she was silent and unmoving, staring fixedly at the large posters for exotic holidays and duty-free goods that were plastered across the curved wall on the other side of the tracks. One of the paramedics had taken the woman's purse from her bag.
"Is your name Sharon, love?"
he asked. She said nothing.
"Come on, love. You have to talk to us."
She remained silent.
"We're going to have to take her in," the paramedic said. "I think she's in shock.
I'll come too,
Milton said. Are you a friend?
Leaving her now would be abandoning her. He had started to help, and he wanted to finish the job. He would leave once her family had arrived.
Yes, he said. Come on, sweetheart. Let's get you checked out properly.
Milton followed behind the ambulance as they took the woman to the Royal Free Hospital. They wheeled her into a quiet room and made her a cup of warm tea full of sugar.
We're just waiting for the doctor, they said to her. Get that down you. It'll make all the difference.
Thank you, she murmured. The paramedic turned to Milton.
Are you all right to stay with her? He's on his way, but it might be 20 minutes.
Yes, Milton said. Of course. He took the seat next to the bed and watched the girl. She had closed her eyes, and after a few minutes, Milton realized that she had drifted into a shallow sleep. Her chest rose and fell with each gentle breath. Milton regarded her. Her hair was of the deepest black, worn cut square and low on the nape of her neck, fanned out on the white hospital linen to frame a sweet, almond-shaped face. Her eyes were wide under finely drawn eyebrows, slightly up-tilted at the corners. Her skin was a perfect chocolate brown and bore no trace of makeup save a light lipstick on her wide and sensual mouth. Her bare arms were slender, and her hands, folded beneath her breasts, were small and delicate. Her fingernails were chewed down, the red varnish chipped. There was no ring on her finger. The restaurant uniform was a utilitarian grey, lasciviously tight across her breasts. The trousers flowed down from a narrow but not thin waist. Her shoes were square-toed and of plain black leather. She was very pretty. Milton let her rest. Chapter 5. She awoke a full 2 hours later. At first, her pretty face maintained the serenity of sleep, but that did not last for very long. Confusion clouded across it, and then, suddenly, came a terrible look of panic. She struggled upright and swung her feet off the bed and onto the floor. "It's all right," Milton said. "You're in hospital. You've been asleep."
"What time is it?"
6.
"Jesus," she said. "I'm so late. My boy, I need to be home."
She looked around, panicked. "Where are we?" "Hospital."
"No," she said, pushing herself onto her feet. "I have to be home. My boy will be there. He won't know where I am. He won't have had his tea. No one's looking after him."
"The doctor's been. He wanted to speak to you. He's coming back when you're awake."
"I can't, and I'm fine. Besides, I know it was a stupid thing to do. I'm not about to do it again. I don't want to die. I can't. He needs me."
She looked into his face. Her expression was earnest and honest.
"They can't keep me in here, can they?"
"I don't think so." She collected her bag from the chair and started for the door.
"How are you going to get home?" Milton asked her. "I don't know. Where is this?"
"The Royal Free."
"Hampstead? I'll get the train."
"Let me drive you."
"You don't have to do that. I live in Dalston. That must be miles out of your way."
"No, that's fine. I live just round the corner, Islington." It was a lie.
"It's not a problem."
The medical staff were uncomfortable about their patient discharging herself, but there was nothing that they could do to stop her. She was not injured, she appeared to be rational, and she was not alone. Milton answered their reflexive concern with a tone of quiet authority that was difficult to oppose. She signed her discharge papers, politely thanked the staff for their care, and followed Milton outside. Milton had parked in the nearby NCP building. He swept the detritus from the passenger seat, opened the door, waited until she was comfortable, and then set off, cutting onto the embankment. He glanced at her through the corner of his eye. She was staring fixedly out of the window, watching the river. It didn't look as if she wanted to talk.
Fair enough.
He switched on the CD player and skipped through the discs until he found the one he wanted to listen to,
a Bob Dylan compilation. Dylan's reedy voice filled the car as Milton accelerated away from a set of traffic lights.
"Thanks for this," Sharon said suddenly. "I'm very grateful."
"It's not a problem."
"My boy should be home. He'd be wanting his tea."
"What's his name?"
"Elijah."
"That's a nice name."
"His father liked it. He was into his Bible."
"How old is he?"
15. "What about you? Do you have any kids?"
"No," Milton said. "It's just me." He pulled out and overtook a slow-moving lorry, and she was silent for a moment.
"It's because of him," she said suddenly. "This morning, all that. I know it's stupid, but I didn't know what else to do. Still don't, not really. I'm at the end of my tether."
"What's happened?"
She didn't seem to hear that. "I don't have anyone else. If I lose him, there's no point in carrying on."
"Why don't you tell me about it?"
She looked out of the window, biting her lip.
"How have you lost him?"
She clenched her jaw. Milton shrugged and reached for the radio. She spoke hurriedly. "There's a gang on the estate where we live. These young lads, local boys. They terrify everyone. They do what they want. Cause trouble, steal things, deal their drugs. No one dares do anything against them."
"The police?"
She laughed bitterly. "No use to no one. They won't even come into the estate unless there's half a dozen of them. It'll calm down a bit while they're around. But as soon as they go again, it's as if they were never even there."
"What do they have to do with Elijah?"
"He's got in with them. He's just a little boy. And I'm supposed to look after him, but there's nothing I can do. They've taken him away from me. He stays out late. He doesn't listen to me anymore. He won't do as he's told. I've always tried to give him a little freedom, not be one of those rowdy Jamaican mothers where the kids can't ever do anything right. But maybe now, I think I ought to have been stricter. Last night was as bad as it's ever been. I know he's been sneaking out late at night to be with them. Normally he goes out of his bedroom window, so I put a lock on it. He comes into the front room and I tell him he needs to get back to bed. He just gives me this look and he says I can't tell him what to do anymore. I tell him I'm his mother and he has to listen to me for as long as he's under my roof. That's reasonable, isn't it?"
"Very."
"So he says that maybe he won't be under my roof for much longer. That he'll get his own money and find somewhere for himself. Where's a 15-year-old boy going to get the money for rent unless it's from thieving or selling drugs?" He goes for the door, but he's got to come by me first, so I get up and stop him. He tells me to get out of the way, and when I won't, he says he hates me. Says that it's my fault his father ain't around, and when I try to get him to calm down, he just pushes me aside, opens the door and goes. He's a big boy for his age, taller than I am already, and he's strong. If he won't do as he's told, what can I do to stop him? He didn't get back in until 3 a.m, and when I woke up to go to work, he was still asleep."
"Have you thought about moving away?"
She laughed humorlessly again. "Do you know how hard that is? We were in a hostel before. I used to live up in Manchester until my husband started knocking me about. There was this place for battered women. We ended up there when we got into London. I'm not knocking it, but it was full up. There was no place to bring up my boy. I was on at the social for months before they gave us our flat. You have no idea the trouble it'd be to get him to move us somewhere else. Nah, we're stuck there."
She paused, staring out at the cars again.
"Ever since we've been in the estate, we've had problems. I worry about Elijah every single day. Every single day I worry about him. Every day I worry."
Milton had started to wonder whether there might be a way that he could help.
"I'm sorry," she said. "Here I am telling you all my troubles. I don't even know your name."
Milton almost reflexively retreated to his training and his long list of false identities, but he stopped himself. What was the point? He had no stomach for any of that any longer. A foundation of lies would not be a good place to start if he wanted to help this woman. "I'm John," he said. "John Milton." He approached the junction for Whitechapel Road and turned off.
"I'm sorry for going on. I'm sure you've got your own problems. You don't need to hear mine."
"I'd like to help."
"That's nice of you, but I don't see how you could."
"Perhaps I could talk to him."
"You're not police, are you?"
"No."
"Or the social?"
"No."
"I don't want to be rude, Mr. Milton, but you don't know Elijah. He's headstrong. Why would he care what you said?"
He slowed down as they approached a queue of slower-moving traffic.
"I can be persuasive."
Chapter 6 Control had requested Milton's file from the archive, and after it had been delivered, he shut himself away in his office with a pot of tea and a cigar and spread the papers around him. It was late when he started. The sun long since set, and the lights of the office blocks on the opposite side of the Thames glittering in the dark waters of the river. He lit the cigar and began his search through the documents for a clue that might explain his sudden and uncharacteristic decision. Their conversation had unsettled him. Milton had always been his best cleaner. His professionalism had always been complete. He maintained a vigorous regimen that meant that he was as fit as men half his age. His body was not the problem. If it was, he mused ruefully, this would have been easier to fix. The problem was with his mind, and that presented a more particular issue. Control prided himself on knowing the men and women who worked for him, and Milton's attitude had taken him by surprise. It introduced an element of doubt into his thinking, and doubt to a man as ordered and logical as Control was not tolerable. He held the smoke in his mouth. Milton's dedication and professionalism had never wavered, not for a moment, and he had completed an exemplary series of assignments that could have formed the basis for an instruction manual for the successful modern operative. He was the group's most ruthless and efficient assassin. He had always treated his vocation as something of an art form, drawing satisfaction from the knowledge of a job well done. Control knew from long and vexatious experience that such an attitude was a rarity these days. Real artisans, real craftsmen, were difficult to find, and when you had one, you nurtured him. The other men and women at his disposal tended towards the blunt. They were automatons that he pointed at targets, then watched and waited as they did their job. Their methods were effective, but crass. A shower of bullets from a slow-moving car. A landmine detonated by mobile phone. Random expressions of uncontrolled violence. It was quick and dirty, flippant and trite. A summation of all that Control despised about modern intelligence. There was no artistry left, no pride taken in the job, no assiduity, no careful deliberation, no real nerve. Milton reminded Control of the men and women he had worked with when he was a field agent himself, posted at Station M in the middle of the Cold War. They had been exact and careful. Their assignments comprising long periods of planning that ended with sudden, controlled, contained violence. Control turned through the pages and found nothing. Perhaps the answer was to be found in his history. He took another report from its storage crate and dropped it on his desk. It was as thick as a telephone directory. In order for a new agent to be admitted to the group, a raft of assessments were required to be carried out. The slightest impropriety, financial, personal, virtually anything, would lead to a black mark, and that would be that. The proposal would be quietly dropped, and the prospective agent would never even know that they had been under consideration. Milton had been no different. MI5 were tasked with the compilation of the reports, and they had done a particularly thorough job with him. They had investigated his childhood, his education, his career in the army, and his personal life. John Milton was born in 1968. He had no brothers or sisters. His father, James Milton, had worked as a petrochemical engineer and led his family on a peripatetic existence, moving every few years as he followed work around the world. Much of Milton's early childhood was spent in the Gulf, with several years in Saudi Arabia, 6 months in Iran during the fall of the Shah, then Egypt, Dubai, and Oman. There had been a posting to the United States and then, finally, the directorship of a medium-sized gas exploration company in London. The young Milton picked up a smattering of Arabic and an ability to assimilate himself into different cultures. Both talents had proven valuable in his later career. His life had changed irrevocably in 1980. His mother and father were killed in a crash on a German autobahn, and John had been sent to live with his aunt and uncle in Kent. A substantial amount of money was bequeathed to him in trust, and it was put to good use. He was provided with a first-class private education, and after passing the rigorous entrance examination, he was sent up to Eton for the autumn term in 1981. His career there was not successful, and thanks to an incident that MI5 had not been able to confirm, although they suspected it involved gambling, Milton was expelled. There was a period of home tutoring before he was accepted at his father's old school. He stayed there until he was 16 and then took a place at Cambridge to read law. He was involved in the OTC, and it had been no surprise to anyone when he ignored the offer of a pupillage at the bar to enlist in the Royal Green Jackets. He was posted to the rifle depot in Winchester and then sent to Gibraltar as part of his first operational posting. He served in South Armagh, where, as a newly promoted Lance Corporal, he killed for the first time during a firefight with the Provisional Irish Republican Army. After spending 8 years with the Green Jackets, he decided to attempt SAS selection. The process was renowned for being brutally difficult, but he passed easily. While serving with Air Troop B Squadron 22 SAS, Milton worked on both covert and overt operations worldwide, including counter-terrorism and drug operations in the Middle East and Far East, South and Central America, and Northern Ireland. He trained as a specialist in counter-terrorism, prime target elimination, demolitions, weapons, tactics, covert surveillance roles, information gathering in hostile environments, and VIP protection. He worked on cooperative operations with police forces, prison services, anti-drug forces, and Western-backed guerrilla movements, as well as on conventional special operations. The Distinguished Conduct Medal he received, together with the military medal that he won during a patrol in Northern Ireland, made Milton the British Army's most highly decorated serving soldier when control decided that he was the perfect replacement for Number 7, who had been killed while on operations in China. He made the pitch himself. It was a persuasive offer, and Milton had accepted immediately. Control put the history aside and turned back to contemporary papers. Milton's recent yearly assessment had been a significant dip in results, and as he turned back through the years, he noticed a trend that had remained hidden until then. The assessments were intense and combined a rigorous physical examination, marksmanship tests, and a psychological evaluation. Milton's performance in all three elements had been in decline over the last 3 years. The drop was steepest this year, but it was not isolated. He chided himself for missing it. His continued success in the field had blinded him. He was so good at his job that the suggestion that he might not have been infallible was ridiculous. Now, as he examined his file with the benefit of hindsight, he saw that he had missed a series of indicators. His physical examinations returned strong results. He was fit, with the cardiovascular profile of a man 15 years younger. He made it his habit to run a marathon every year, and the times had been noted and added to the file. He had never finished the course in more than 3.5 hours. Nevertheless, he had suffered a series of injuries in the field that had exerted a toll on his body. Since joining Group 15, he had been shot twice, stabbed in the leg and shoulder, and had broken more than a dozen bones. He reported the usual aches and pains, but the physician suggested that he was being stoic for the benefit of the examination, and that it was likely that he was in mild to moderate pain most of the time. Blood tests detected the beginning of mild arthritis in his joints, a condition for which there was a familial history. He took a cocktail of drugs, gabapentin for his nerve damage and oxycodone for general pain relief. Control relit his cigar and picked up his psychological assessment. He stood to stretch his legs and read the report next to the window. As he skimmed through the pages, he realized that missing the warning signs contained within had been his most egregious error. The psychiatrist noted that Milton had complained of sleeplessness and that he had been prescribed promethazine to combat it. There had been a discussion about reasons behind the problem, but Milton had become agitated and then angry, refusing to accept that it was anything other than an inability to quieten a busy mind. The psychiatrist suggested that Milton's naturally melancholic temperament indicated mild depression, and that he seemed to have become introspective and doubting. The report concluded with the recommendation that he be monitored on a more regular basis. Control had ignored it. Damn it! Milton was a valuable asset, and he had willfully ignored the warning signs. He did not want to admit that there might be a problem, and his inaction had allowed it to metastasize. He put the files back into the storage crate and lit a second cigar. There came a knock at the door.
"Come in,"
he called. Christopher Callan came into the office. He was number 12, the most recent recruit to the group. He had been transferred from the special boat service after a career every bit as glittering as Milton's had been. He was tall and slender and impeccably dressed. His jacket was two-buttoned, cut from 9-ounce cloth. The pockets were straight and the lining was simple and understated. There was a telltale faint bulge beneath his left armpit where he wore his shoulder holster. He did not wear a tie. The trousers were classically cut, falling down to the back of his shoe. He was strikingly handsome, although his head was round and small, supported by a muscular neck. His scalp was covered with tight blonde curls that were almost white, reminding Control of the classical hair of the statues of Da Vinci. The curls were thickly pressed against each other and against the skull. His skin was a pristine white and his grooming immaculate. There was a cruelty to his thin-lipped mouth, and the implacability that veiled those pale blue eyes seemed to infect the whole face. It was, Control reflected with a moment of mild revulsion, as if someone had taken a china doll and painted its face to frighten.
"You wanted to see me, sir," he said.
"Yes, Callan, take a seat."
He inhaled deeply, taking the smoke all the way back into his throat, then blowing it out.
"We've got a bit of a problem. It's one of the other agents. Do you know Number One?"
"Only by reputation."
"You never worked with him, though."
"No, sir. Why?"
"Afraid he's started to behave a little erratically. I want to find out everything you can about him. Where he's living, what he does with his time, who he's seeing. Everything you can."
"Yes, sir. Anything else?"
"No. Start immediately, please."
"Of course." Callan stood and straightened his jacket. Number one was in France, sir. The Iranian scientists.
That's right.
Callan nodded thoughtfully. That was unfortunate. Control looked at him and knew that he would have followed the rules of engagement to the letter. He would not have left any witnesses. He had the same single-minded ruthlessness as Milton when he joined. He had made a reputation for it in the SBS. That was the characteristic that had appealed to Control when he had recruited him.
Daily reports, please, number 12. Get started at once. You're dismissed.
He turned to face the window again, the door closing softly behind him. He gazed through the cloud of cigar smoke, through his pensive reflection, and out into the darkness beyond. Traffic streamed along Millbank on the other side of the river, taillights leaving a red smear across the tarmac. He thought of Milton. Control was a craftsman too. His agents were his tools. Sometimes, when they got old and unreliable, when their edge grew rusty and could no longer be whetted, they had to be replaced. Perhaps it was time. He wondered if that was what he would have to do.